chick flicks, romantic comedies, rom-coms. You love them, you hate them.
But we are here to eviscerate them. Welcome to the Rom-Com Killjoys podcast.
We are your hosts, Eliza Bertrand
and Janelle Walker. Now, let's get on with some feminist joy killing.
Welcome back, everybody. We are in our final week of Golden Age of Hollywood Month, and we have a bit of a twofer for you this week because we're going to be talking about an original and a remake. The original features pretty strongly the song Isn't It Romantic, which I think is a great song for this discussion because we're really going to be answering the question, is it romantic? Or is it just kind of creepy?
Yes, I'm ready to talk, to weigh in on the May, December, or do we really actually want to call it the May and all the way around to several Decembers ago? romance?
Yeah, it's like a January, December, or however you would do that. But to discuss this questionable romance, we've brought on someone who I think might be an expert in this film. Chelsea, say hi to everyone.
Hello, listeners. First off, I'd like to say that in this month of November, I'm so glad that the people's voice was heard and that democracy won. I'm so glad that Sabrina was chosen because I was seriously considering stuffing the ballot box. I have many, many thoughts and feelings about the 1995 remake of Sabrina. I would consider it one of my top three favorite films. Maybe because of Stockholm Syndrome, maybe because I've been watching it for 25 years, but it's definitely up there for me, and it's one of my touchstone pieces of media, so I have a lot of thoughts and feelings.
I mean, Chelsea, don't worry. We've all been sort of emotionally kidnapped by Harrison Ford at one point or another, so I don't blame you.
Right, like, if you're going to be obsessed with a really problematic movie from your childhood with a problematic lead, at least that problematic lead is Harrison Ford.
I think with all that being said, I feel like it's clear that at this point we're talking about Sabrina, also known as Sabrina Fair in the UK, its original play title. Eliza, why don't you hit us with a little summary?
So we're going to be talking about both Sabrinas, the 1954 version and the 1995 version. But I'm just going to go ahead and read the summary from the original movie, since the summary is pretty much the same other than the names of the actors. So let's hear what Google has to say. Chauffeur's daughter, Sabrina, Audrey Hepburn, returns home from 2 years in Paris, a beautiful young woman, and immediately catches the attention of David, William Holden, the playboy son of her father's rich employers. David woos and wins Sabrina, who has always been in love with him. However, their romance is threatened by David's serious older brother, Linus, Humphrey Bogart, who runs the family business and is relying on David to marry an heiress in order for a crucial merger to take place. Well, folks, that's what Google says this movie is about, but, Janelle, Chelsea, what's this movie really about?
I mean, who among us doesn't want to move to a new city for a couple years and return absolutely transformed, like attractive, cute, deep, funny, witty, you know, attracting billionaires? So I think a large part of the story is just pure fantasy. And I think that Sabrina Fair is based on a play, and I found the New York Times review from 1953, and they're talking about how it's essentially like a bedroom comedy or a bedroom farce, kind of in the way of Noel Coward. And it's just this very lighthearted, everybody's going to end up married in the end. There's going to be a happy ending. The review kind of talked about how you know where it's going. It's all about enjoying the journey. And I think it's pretty obvious that this is just a setup and doesn't necessarily rely on chemistry or displays of romance in order to get to the end of the plot.
Yeah, I really have to agree with you on that one, because it's interesting. In the summary, you know, it says David woos and wins Sabrina, and he really doesn't have to do anything to woo her other than, like, notice that she is alive and a woman and suddenly look at her, and then, like, he's won her over. But on the other hand, Linus, the older brother, also doesn't necessarily do a lot to woo her. Like, the big romantic gestures are not strong in this movie. And I also think it's fair to say that the chemistry is not necessarily strong in this movie either, at least in the original one.
I would disagree. I think that Audrey Hepburn and William Holden are ready to sex each other up on the dance floor.
And behind the scenes trivia, William Holden and Audrey Hepburn fell in love while filming this movie, but Audrey Hepburn dumped him after she learned he was infertile.
I think another piece of trivia is that they were originally considering William Holden for Linus, but thought he was too young. So, and they also wanted the big name of Humphrey Bogart to pull in as another anchor in the cast. Mm-hmm. So they were really relying on the bankability of their stars, even if it, you know, the chemistry wasn't there or even the basic demonstrations of falling in love.
Yeah, this is definitely a bit of a curveball from Humphrey Bogart. This is not the part that he normally plays. And I don't necessarily think he plays it badly, but you can see why he wasn't often cast as a leading man in, like, lighthearted romance movies. He tends to be in more serious pieces. And he plays it like he's in Casablanca in this or something. You know, while, like, then you have, you know, Audrey Hepburn, like, flouncing around being Audrey Hepburn in her Givenchy dresses.
She's
and
so giggly.
There's a definite tonal difference in the way the actors are portraying their parts, mm-hmm. I would say.
I would just add into this conversation, too, that there is an ideological angle to this film. I always have to take it there. There's, like, two things that I want to point out that are going on in this film. One, to Chelsea's point, it's kind of a class fantasy in a lot of ways. It's like a post-war consumerist fantasy of someone moving up the class ranks via consumables like food, like fashion, to be part of this bourgeois like life of leisure that both Linus and Sabrina end up achieving at the end mm-hmm. of the film. And also, relevant to the Humphrey Bogart points you all are making, one of the things that I find really interesting about this movie is it's sort of, we talked last week about Marilyn Monroe's star text, and I think that in this movie, I was intrigued by how Audrey Hepburn being paired with Humphrey Bogart is almost this sort of like meta text about how he's on his way out of his career, his like December, you know, and she's at the height of her career. She had just won an Oscar for Roman Holiday and is at the sort of mm-hmm. May of her career. Mm-hmm. So there's something really intriguing about what maybe the studio was trying to say about both of their, you know, celebrity at the time.
I was very startled at the industries that both the Larrabees and also the fiance's family are involved in. The fiance's family owns the second largest sugarcane plantation in Puerto Rico. You see Linus Larrabee involved in all of these deals around the world, you know, Iraqi oil, the advent of plastics. And it really struck me at how kind of reflecting the capitalist imperialist mindset of the 1950s, particularly in America, where this was like the new way of extending American influence around the world. And I was really, really struck by the choices that they made in the various industries that we're in. Linus Larrabee is an unrepentant billionaire in both movies, so eat the rich.
You know, there's definitely, he is like on the cutting edge of technology and industry at the time. They're trying to make that clear, right? Like they're talking about really advanced plastics. He's, you know, dealing with oil and all these kind of things. Mm-hmm. But it also is sort of irrelevant to the plot at the same time. You know, as often happens in these, you have some sort of just kind of a framework to put the characters in so that you have this shorthand and understand just how rich they are, just what kind of people they are. But like, it's not about his business savvy that comes into it. It's a much more sort of old-fashioned kind of aristocratic, I know how to deal with this dumb poor woman kind of thing at mm-hmm. the beginning, right? Like he's just like, oh, I'll distract her and we'll distract my brother, and then the just like the arranged marriage will go on as planned. You know, it's this very sort of old-fashioned attitude towards romance and marriage at the time yeah. when you've also got this family that's supposed to be like right on the cutting edge of the industries.
You hear this refrain, it's the 20th century, so this should be acceptable. But Linus is a very heavy hand in manipulating everyone around him. I think one of the things that stood out to me is Linus is very duplicitous in trying to convince David. When he's trying to prevent David from consummating this relationship with Sabrina, he's feeding into the narrative that he's the good guy, that he supports their relationship, that he's on David's side, but is actually the one who's engineering this entire situation that ultimately hurts physically his brother and emotionally Sabrina.
Well, and that's what's interesting about Linus's journey is that the film has us see him as this like unrepentant billionaire capitalist, right, who believes in these old world values, including the sort of upstairs downstairs configuration of their mm-hmm. household, where we see the servant class and the kind of luxury class intermingling. And he's so against Sabrina and David being together, in part because she's a servant and it embarrasses their family, and she's just another person they have to pay off. But by the end of the movie, he wants her. So there's kind of this like resolution of the class conflict by the end of the film vis-a-vis Linus's, I guess, change of heart about Sabrina, which is kind of bizarre.
Especially, I think it's underserved by the fact that they don't have any chemistry and that the plot, the script, really doesn't do anything to show you how they're working on their relationship or actually why they would be attracted to each other. Because they are very, very different people. There's no, to me, in the 54 version, there's no real synthesis or demonstration of how they'd be compatible.
Yeah, I agree. I think that, you know, we've been talking about their chemistry, but the plot itself also lacks. Mm-hmm. You know, we're just sort of told that now they like each other. And there's not a lot of explanation in world to really explain why. You know, if he genuinely were being kind to her, but just trying to steer her away from his brother, then maybe it would be a little more understandable. But everything he does is to manipulate her away from his brother. Like, that's the only purpose. And then he doesn't really go out of his comfort zone to, like, do anything for her or change for her or be kind to her or, I don't know, even be, like, funny or charming beyond sort of the norm. And so when she's just suddenly like, oh, well, maybe I have feelings for you, you as the audience are going, like, why? Are you sure?
I mean, that Givenchy isn't going to buy itself, so...
Right, and if that's all it was, I'd buy it more. The other thing is, like, the younger brother also sucks, right? Especially in this first movie. He's just the worst. He's a playboy. He's completely, like, he doesn't want to marry this woman that he proposed to, but he also just wants to, like, flirt around. And then he sees Sabrina, and she's pretty, and he's like, oh, she's the woman of my dreams. And you know that 2 days later, like, he's going to fall for someone else. So it's not like you're rooting for Sabrina to be with him. But I kind of find myself rooting for her to be with neither of them and to just, like, pack her bags and head off on her own.
This is definitely a point that I want to raise when we talk about the 1995. But I will also say that in this movie, David has never once consented to this marriage. He's just forced into it by his family. It's entirely arranged by Linus. So I actually do have a little bit of sympathy for David because he is a victim of his family's machinations. Like, he hasn't voiced any agency in this relationship. He's just kind of going along to get along. But yeah, he is a bit of a playboy and he's not deeply sketched. So his one real characteristic is that he likes to play around and isn't a serious human.
I guess my question in response to that is, you know, the framework from the beginning of the movie that we get is that Sabrina grew up on their estate because her father worked for them and she's had a crush on David for, you know, for all of these years, for this whole time, and he's never noticed her, but she's seen him woo woman after woman after woman, and he has, like, the same moves that he does time and again. And when she comes back, and she's been to Paris, and she's fashionable, and she's older, and she's cut her hair, he does the same thing to her, and she's completely swept up by it. And so my question for both of you is, did you find that a realistic portrayal of a woman?
Well, here was my thinking about that. Like, the way that I read that was that Sabrina was essentially getting, I think Chelsea mentioned this earlier, her wish fulfillment. This was her fantasy from her earliest childhood days. And so she was really getting to fulfill it in part. But what's interesting, if we want to go to like a sexuality psychoanalysis level with it, Linus is the one who consummates her ultimate fantasy in the indoor tennis court, in the solarium. So there's a sense in which he usurps her fantasy, thereby displacing David from the jump.
I would also raise the point that they explicitly mention Sabrina's age. Someone mentions that she's 22. She is very, very young compared to these older male figures. So when she's leaving, she's 20. She's essentially a teenager by the time she goes to Paris. So she's also definitely on a different level of maturity, on understanding what a real relationship is. Mm-hmm. And I think that if she spent 2 years just thinking about this and eventually growing up a little bit, but still holding this as a core part of her desires and her goals, then yeah, I think that she would take a night of romance at a fabulous party and a brief fling at a tennis court. Why not?
Sure, fair enough. Especially, I mean, if you're going to wear that dress, you might as well make it count, right?
I mean.
But I feel like that does bring us to the elephant in the room, which we've touched on but not, like, really dug into, which is the age differences here. And I looked it up, I checked the math. Audrey Hepburn, at the time of filming this movie, was 24, playing a character who's 22. Humphrey Bogart was 53. A full 30 years older than her. And William Holden is 35, which means that there's supposed to be a 20-year age difference between these two brothers, which is this whole other kettle of fish there. But we've got this romance between a 24-year-old child who's depicted as even younger than she actually is in the movie, and then a man who is 53 years old. And it's even acknowledged in the movie but like briefly, and then they move on.
Yep, she basically gets shuttled from one daddy to another with a brief dalliance with her sort of like teenage love, and it is the classic patriarchal narrative. Like, I give you my daughter's hand, man to man, we shake on it and it's over.
Yeah, it's her life is very defined by the men in it and the decisions they make for her. She does not have a lot of agency in this movie.
Well, yeah, so this is another point that I want to raise about the 1995 version. More to the age difference, and, you know, negotiating age within a relationship can be tricky, but there are relationships with significant age differences that work. I think it's less about age and more about power. So in this movie, Sabrina, as you say, she's ruled by the men in her life. Linus is this titan of industry. They have incredible resources at their disposal, whereas Sabrina doesn't. And one thing that's actually interesting is contrasting to the play. In the play, there's a character, Sabrina actually gets a suitor in Paris who follows her back. And her father gets this, he develops his own independent fortune. So in the play version, and also this is somewhat reflected in the 95, Sabrina has independent, independent resources and support. She has these things that kind of level the playing field between her and the brothers, which are completely stripped away in this version. I think in comparison to the 1995 version, Sabrina is hardly a different character from when, from pre-Paris to post-Paris. She barely changes. She just gets a fashionable haircut and a better wardrobe, but she's still essentially the same person, which I think fundamentally places her on the back foot in terms of agency and poise and understanding herself and her ability to negotiate this relationship with Linus, who is so domineering, so heavy-handed in the way that he controls the people in his life. So I think it's more about the power difference between the two characters, even though age really does play a massive part of this.
Yeah, I would add to that reading, and I guess maybe even counter what you're saying, Chelsea, by adding that because the 54 version has that attempted suicide scene where Linus saves Sabrina from suicide, it sets up this understanding that she was in dire straits before she went to Paris, and when she comes back, she's this more whole person. But while I think that dramaturgically that works for me and does sort of make sense about her transformation, but it's problematic as hell, and we should talk about it. It is so disturbing to me that Linus saves her from this suicide attempt that she makes over David of all people, and that we're just supposed to see that as sort of her like childhood fancy, her immature reactions to love, and the person that saves her from that, Linus.
Yeah, it's very strange. I mean, first of all, it's just very dark, especially because the whole opening of the movie is her pining after this man and then deciding to kill herself very sort of melodramatically. And then the movie ultimately becomes a sort of, you know, happy fairy tale-esque romance. So it's the tonal shift is very strange and not necessarily what you're expecting going into the movie. But it also, like so many things in this movie, I feel like isn't fully dealt with. You know, he catches her and you think he understands that she's trying to commit suicide, but she talks her way out of it and like makes it sound like, oh no, I'm just an idiot and I didn't realize what I was doing. And he seems to also sort of accept that. So you don't know if he's just playing along or if he really just believes she's that dumb. And then later on, he sort of implies that he's dealt with depression because of relationships he's been in and stuff, but like it's never fully discussed. And then maybe that's kind of why they bonded, but not fully. It's a very strange element.
And the tone of the suicide scene itself is so bizarre. Like, for people who haven't seen the 54 version, it's a suicide scene where she goes into a garage and turns on all the car exhausts so that, you know, she gets carbon monoxide poisoning. But one of the cars doesn't work, so it starts puffing out smoke rings like a laugh line. It's the weirdest thing I've ever seen.
You really do have to lighten up a suicide, Janelle. You really do need those comedic elements.
Thanks, 1950s.
So I mentioned that I hadn't seen this movie in probably like 15 years. The two things I remembered were the suicide scene because it was so jarring compared to my knowledge of the other version, the remake. And then the second thing is 1, 2, 3, crack, Newegg. This movie taught me how to crack eggs properly. But yeah, it almost feels like this scene was added in for melodrama, just to be sensationalist rather than actually informing who the characters are or ultimately why they may find each other as suitable partners.
Yeah, and I think this might be a good time to segue into talking about the remake in 1995, because one of the biggest changes in the remake is that they do not have this suicide scene, among other things, but that's definitely one of sort of the most glaring differences. So for those who don't know, in 1995, they made this movie again, also called Sabrina, this time starring Julia Ormond, Harrison Ford, and Greg Kinnear as the younger brother. And it's at moments a shot-for-shot, line-for-line remake, and then there are some significant changes that they throw in there, presumably to modernize it. So I guess my question for you guys is, do you feel it's a successful remake? Do you think that they fixed the problems of the original, and do you think it has any new problems?
I think I want to get the jump on Chelsea here just to start a fight, so get ready.
Do it!
Here's my thing about the 1995 remake. While I admire its feminist, taking a pause, feminist adaptation of this film and its specific tonal shifts, especially the change in the suicide scene and the way that it makes the relationship between Sabrina and Linus more believable and more intimate, first, it's not that funny. And I thought the Sabrina 54 was really funny, which, you know, counts for very little, but let's count it for what it is.
Oh, no.
She's gonna fight me. Okay, give me my second point. My second point is that while I am a 90s kid, I will say that I have a sort of distaste for what I call the like late 30s divorced mom trying to find herself tone of some of the rom-coms from that period. And this, the 1995 version has some pieces of that for me, including the baggy beige pantsuits. Maybe I just love Givenchy, but there were just things aesthetically that I did not care for with the 95. I'm sorry, Chelsea. Please wreck me.
That is a fair point, but I would like to counter that whereas you're talking about the clothing choices and maybe we should chastise the costume designer, I have, like, valid points about characterization and themes, so, yeah.
I'm gonna cut in really fast, because I know you have a million things to say. But I'm gonna say that on this, I side more with Janelle, and here are my two reasons. I think there are a lot of updates that they do that improve the characters, and I think there are updates that make them worse.
First off, I think that there is a structural problem with the character of Sabrina as a whole. I think she's way better in the 1995 version, but both characters kind of fall into the trope of, like, there's a specific trope for female characters. Demonstrations of this is Mila Jovovich's character in The Fifth Element, where it's like the dumb baby. You know, women as just kind of this blank slate who are completely guileless and naive about the world. I think that Audrey Hepburn Sabrina is just super giggly and very shallow and superficial. She's just designed to be this object of attraction. Whereas the 95 Sabrina is like, she's almost so naive about the world as to, she doesn't feel grounded to me. And that's definitely something I picked up on in this version. So I think that Sabrina itself, or herself, is not a super realistic character, and I think that that's a disservice to both films. Linus in the 95 version is actually even more of a villain.
Agreed.
Because
they make him worse, like darker. Yeah. At least
he both like physically assaults and then roofies his brother. Like, David, poor dude. I think that David is a little less sympathetic in this movie because they do give him more agency in his relationship with Elizabeth. So he is actually the one who has initiated this romantic relationship, and it is almost bordering on cheating when he's voicing interest in Sabrina. But I think David, poor dude, he just wants to be seen. They make it more explicit. They color in more about David's character and why he's such a shallow person in this family, why he's disengaged from the company, why he doesn't consider himself serious, why he doesn't pursue these deep romantic relationships. So I think part of the reason they make it more explicitly clear as to he's enamored by Sabrina's attraction to him, because no one in his life really has demonstrated this interest in such a clear and concise way. So I think he's looking for something emotionally that his family isn't giving him. The two characters that I think really elevate the 1995 version above the 1954 version are the character of Irene, Sabrina's female mentor at Vogue. And I think that working at Vogue is better than working at the Cordon Bleu, just saying. Irene has one of my favorite speeches in the whole movie. It's this 3-minute scene where she's just imparting this wisdom that I really think starts Sabrina on her journey. And she's talking about how she came to Paris uneducated, alone. She didn't have a job. She didn't know herself. So she just spent all of this time on introspection and really, really getting to know herself before she launched into the world and became this really successful woman. And she has this line that I have taken with me in, you know, in every part of my life, that you seem embarrassed by loneliness, by being alone, but it's only a place to start. And I think that this is such a, like, this is one of my favorite lessons that I've ever adopted from media and pop culture.
Oh, because... Chelsea, I thought of you when I heard that line. That warms my heart. I was like, this is like Chelsea's ethos. It's so beautiful.
Yeah, I think this speech is so powerful because it's all about, like, you need to start from a place where you're secure in yourself. And that allows, or that supports you in being secure in the world. And it's not embarrassing to be alone and to really, really get into yourself. And I think that this speech and this theme separates the 1995 version and actually equalizes somewhat Sabrina and Linus in their relationship, because Sabrina has done the work. She is fine without Linus. She goes to Paris by herself and she is ready to resume her life. At the end of this movie, Linus is lucky that Sabrina has deigned to take him back or to even attempt a romantic relationship. So I think that the difference between the 95 Sabrina and the 1954 Sabrina are night and day. Finally, I think that the character of Fairchild, Sabrina's father, is vastly improved in the new movie. In the 1954 version, Sabrina's dad is just like, yeah, you can screw over my daughter just as long as you're not doing it in front of me. And there's this refrain that, like, you shouldn't reach for the moon. So he's essentially telling his daughter to adhere to the class structure and to stay within her station and live this small life. Whereas Fairchild in the 95 version explicitly states, you don't deserve her. Fairchild is a much better character.
I find that so interesting that you say, because I actually had a sort of the opposite reaction to the two versions of the father. You know, I like at the end that he says, you don't deserve her, but, like, that also comes across as just, like, a dad being overprotective. And I agree with him in this instance, because I don't actually particularly like Harrison Ford's character by the end. But, you know, the line itself didn't, like, wow me. But in general, I didn't actually like their portrayal of her father in this movie, because the movie feels the need to guarantee you that he's not just a blue-collar worker in a way that I found quite demeaning. Because she's got this whole line where she's like, Father, do you know what the thing is that I like best about you? It's that you chose to become a chauffeur so that you could have more time to read. And then in the end, you find out that he's, like, been secretly, you know, working, you know, has stocks in the stock market and has been working them, you know, all these years so that now he's a millionaire. And they couldn't just, like, let him be a chauffeur. And, you know, the thing about the father in the first one is that, yes, he does sort of encourage his daughter to stick to the class structures a bit, but it's partly because he understands the class structures and he worries that she is being taken advantage of by these rich assholes. And in both of the movies, he has the line, she doesn't, you know, belong in their world, but she doesn't belong in mine over a garage either. So, like, he understands that she has social climbed a bit. He's just worried, I think, about her social climbing too much and then getting burned for it. But it really bothered me in the newer movie that they felt the need to be like, don't worry, he's not just some uneducated chauffeur. He reads.
I think his wealth is actually a plot point from the original play that they changed in the 54 version. But to counter that point, at one point he's having a conversation with another member of the staff. And in the 54 version, he says, there's the back seat and the front seat and a window in between. But in the 1995 version, he's speaking with Joanna, the chef, and he says, she doesn't belong in the mansion, but she doesn't belong in the garage. And Joanna says, most people live in between. So I think that's the ideological difference between the two, is that in the 54 version, there is this rigid barrier between the upper crust and normal people, and you can't break that. It's supposed to be upheld. But in the 95 version, it's at least nodding towards social mobility and understanding that there's this blending that society doesn't uphold these, like, super, super rigid ideologies.
Right, but saying that in the script but having no characters who actually live in that in-between, I feel like doesn't really underlie the point very well.
Well, and I wonder, too, about how, like, okay, so if we take that as the kind of philosophy of the 95 version, that there is space for social mobility between the front seat and the back seat, so to speak, then what does the ending tell us about that ideology? I think that's always key with these movies, because ultimately the ending is the punctuation mark they want to leave you with.
Right, and I feel like in the end, she's joined the upper class. Like, yes, you know, Linus's character has chosen to, like, give up a lot of his responsibilities at the office in order to go and, like, live in Paris with her on this romantic adventure, but I don't think it's implied that he gives up any of his money.
I think that based on just the climate of the 90s versus the 50s, I think it is a little more ambiguous. I think that they may kind of go through a growth in their relationship. I don't know if they stay together. I've been watching this movie for 25 years and I never really come across, like, decided one way or another if I think that they end up together or if they dissolve. I don't know.
You know, I love to speculate always about the cultural context of these movies and the time they were made, and I actually think that this question about the difference between the mid-50s and the mid-90s is a really good one. Like, in the mid-50s, in terms of class ascension, I mean, you're thinking about a broader sort of global narrative about all rising tides float all boats, the coming of globalization and the, you know, the explosion of capitalism all over the world, thanks to the U.S.'s imperialism, is going to bring everybody great joy. Like, Linus has that incredible and very disturbing speech in the 1954 version about how great it is that he's going to bring jobs and toothpaste and movies on Saturday night to people in Puerto Rico, right? Very disturbing.
And that's what convinces David to agree to the marriage.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Exactly. So there's a kind of like, there's a philosophy there that's really about, like, we're all gonna rise up and Sabrina's gonna be part of this new capitalist world. And in the 90s, you're dealing with a different level of late capitalism, you know, a time where we're starting to be really reflective about what capitalism's effect has had on us. It's post-80s, it's post the indulgence of the 80s, but we're still not quite at the dot-com boom and bust. We're not quite at the 2008 collapse, so we're still pretty invested in money as a way to move up in the world, and also in high class, you know, high culture as something that should be prized, right? So her being at Vogue is no coincidence, right? The fact that her sophistication and her self exploration comes from this internship at Vogue is very, very much of its moment, I think. So I think that's all to say that I think you're right, Chelsea, that it's much more ambiguous in the 90s. But I do think it's interesting to look at how both films are reflective of that cultural moment's relationship to money and class.
I will also say, I think that the character that suffers the most because of this time period jump is the character of Linus. And partly that's because in the 1950s movie, especially with him already being a 50-year-old man, right, so he's been around for a long time, you can excuse a lot of his opinions about the world and about class structure and whatever as being sort of old-fashioned and rooted in family expectations and all these kind of things, whereas the Harrison Ford version of the character is depicted as just being quite greedy, honestly, and not even monetarily greedy, but he's just sort of a, like, savvy businessman who's making important business decisions, and he just wants to make more money for the company and the family, and that's why he makes a lot of the decisions. And I think they try to update it so that he's got, like, a softer side, but I'm not sure it's as successful as they wanted it to be, because that sort of attitude does feel much more old-fashioned when you're putting it into 1995 context.
I thought it was really interesting that they replaced the Larrabee Sr. in the 54 version with Linus and David's mother in the 95 version. Mm-hmm. And you really do see Linus's patriarchal attitude in the way that he's interacting with his mother. And even though he's her son, her child, he really adopts this attitude of, I know best. Like, I taught this, or you taught this to me, you taught me how to behave this way, and now I'm doing this because this is what we need to succeed, and I know best. And his mother kind of pushes back on that, and he's like, this is the way it's going to go.
Honestly, I really like the mother in the 1995 version. I think she's a great addition to the story. I think that's one of the really powerful changes that they made. One, just because it's sort of, she's fleshed out, and so the whole family is fleshed out. And I just find her very realistic. And she's fun at the end. You know, at the end, they sort of have everyone kind of gang up in order to prove to Linus that he's in love and convince him to go off with her, and the mother's involved in that, so that's a lot more fun than just having this, like, brawl between the two brothers. But, like, the one moment early on when they're trying to figure out how to sort of talk Sabrina out of this infatuation with David is she says, I should just go and tell her that he's a playboy and he's just yanking her chain. I guess I shouldn't do that. And I was screaming at the TV. I was like, no, you should go do, like, he's definitely not actually in love with her, and you should absolutely, as a woman, just walk over and be like, my son's an idiot. He's yanking your chain. Please don't think he's in love with you. And they just never follow through on that. And I was like, no, no, that was the right move. Sending your older son to go pretend to be in love with her in order to distract her and trick her into moving back to Paris is not the right move when you could have fixed this by just saying, I think my son's a playboy.
But Eliza, then the movie would have ended after half an hour.
I mean, that's a great point. But in that case, why put in the solution to the movie at 25 minutes in? No, I know. But that's just such a great line, except that it's like an actual solution to the problem. So I found it a frustrating line.
Similar point. I was very sad that Sabrina didn't stay with her French photographer boyfriend because I was like, yes, babe, you're working at Vogue and you have a handsome French photographer boyfriend. Yeah. Like, what are you doing? Why would you go back to Long Island? Like, what?
Right, like, there's no point. And also, they do age up Sabrina. She's played by an actress who's 30 years old, which, like, again, there's still a 30-year age gap or a 20-year age gap between her and Linus. But she is older, but that also makes it weirder that she, like, returns home to her father because you're like, you're a 30-year-old with a job at Vogue Paris. Like, you don't need to move back into the garage.
I think that they are also aging down to Sabrina. They never explicitly state her age, and Julia Ormond is an older actress compared to Audrey Hepburn. But I think that Sabrina is still supposed to be fairly young. I think this also leans into Janelle's point about the fashion and how once, you know, Julia Ormond as a 30-year-old actress does look decidedly middle-aged when you put her in a taupe pantsuit.
Okay. What a fucking boner killer that the 54 version, sorry, okay, famously,
I killed my boner, Janelle, I'm right there with you,
right? Like, you know that the 54 version famously had the dresses designed by Givenchy for Audrey Hepburn, and they won the best costume Oscar, which was a whole travesty, but we can talk about that at a different time. And then you have the 1995 version working at Vogue Paris. And she still wears baggy beige pantsuits. Why 1995?
I know. Why? When she's standing on the street and he notices her for the first time, I was like, why? Like, she's just in, like, a gray suit.
She gets such a good haircut, though. This haircut apparently rocked Hollywood because Julia Ormond was famous for her long, luscious locks. But her haircut, Janelle, and the red lips.
Okay, but you just love her haircut because you can pull off that haircut, Chelsea.
Also true.
Those of us who do not have those luscious locks cannot pull off that haircut, and it makes us angry.
Neater.
Ladies and gentlemen, go to our social media in order to see a picture of Chelsea's luscious locks.
I would also love to contend Janelle's point about this not being a funny movie. Maybe it's because I have been indoctrinated for the last 25 years, but I think that Linus Larrabee is fucking hilarious. It's Wednesday, David, is one of my favorite line readings in a movie, and that's what I always say that in my head when someone is being, like, a particular meatball.
Yeah, I do think that Harrison Ford's comedic timing is far superior to Humphrey Bogart's. Oh. I don't think that they wrote him enough comedy. I think there are moments where his character is quite funny, and it's not consistently written, which made me disappointed because his comedic timing is so goddamn good. I mean, go back and watch any of the original three Star Wars. Every joke in there was literally put in by Harrison Ford. But yeah, he is quite funny. And I also think Greg Kinnear's character is really well done, because I love Greg Kinnear and everything he does. And I think that they update him quite well, and he's quite a funny and more emotional character as well.
Even though I think that David, in their big argument in the 95 version, David makes an ad hominem attack to when Linus is laying out all of these reasons why he should commit. David has a particularly witty comeback that's just, your idea of commitment is giving your date enough time to order dessert. And I was like, that is vicious, buddy.
Yeah, I think he's a lot smarter than his character in the 54 version. Which ultimately I think does help. It means when he, like, falls for Sabrina after 5 seconds, it feels a little disingenuous because you've seen and you will see that he is deeper than that. But if you take it as a sort of, like, he's panicking about marriage, he's not ready to commit, he's not really sure how to handle this adulthood thing, like, then you can kind of believe that he makes this one big mistake. But everything else he does is much more intelligent and, I think, more interesting.
I also like the fact that in the 95 version, they keep Humphrey Bogart's bow ties for Harrison Ford.
Does Harrison Ford ever carry an umbrella?
Harrison Ford does not carry an umbrella, nor does he wear a Homburg.
I was sort of sad to lose the umbrella and Homburg jokes, just because I found those really, like, anything sartorial in that 1954 version is so charming. But also I learned that Cary Grant turned down the role of Linus because he didn't want to carry an umbrella on screen, which is the funniest thing I've ever heard.
Toxic masculinity, what?
Well, it's also sad that they lose those sort of sartorial touches because they write in that she goes to Paris to work at Vogue, right? So that would be the perfect opportunity for them to have those flirty scenes where she's like, well, if you're going to move to Paris, you have to wear your hat like this and you can't carry an umbrella. Like, those would be really great moments for the two of them to flirt, and I don't know why they cut rid of them.
It's like they intended to do that and, like, someone forgot.
But I also think that this Sabrina is very different in that she's much more, like, she's much more sensitive. She's definitely not as jokey or as lightly sketched as the Sabrina in the 54 version. So she's not necessarily someone to make these jokes. When Sabrina does kind of lean into the, there's a scene in the 95 version where she's reiterating commonly told jokes about Linus, but she's not really a funny character herself. So she doesn't really flirt and banter. I think that the Sabrina in the 95 version is much more tied into like the emotional aspect of Linus, and that's partially why she unlocks him.
I get that, but part of the problem is that Linus is such a serious person, so I feel like the movie could have really benefited by having her be a little more flirty and bantery and lighthearted, and then bringing that side out in him. Not totally changing him, but just like seeing that he does have that in him, because you see a little bit of that in his interactions with his brother, but not so much with her. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's a failing that would have been pretty easy to fix.
So what we're really saying is that we want the 1954 Audrey Hepburn Sabrina with the 1995 Harrison Ford Linus.
Yes.
And I want him to come to Paris to be with her in her life. And she's like, oh, fabulous. You want to hang out with me in Paris while I, you know, actualize myself? Great.
My headcanon for Sabrina is that she left Paris like maybe 5 days before. So she just picks up her internship immediately. She moves back into the same apartment and resumes her life. All of her friends were like, did you go away for the weekend? And she's like, yeah, I didn't quit my job and move out. What?
Well, I feel like we're not going to get any better of an ending than that.
Before we talk about what I assume will be our antidotes, we always want to give a shout out to our patrons on Patreon, specifically our romantic leads, and they are Bob, Esther, Ian, and Trey. Y'all are great. If I could take you to Paris, I would.
Yes, and this movie was in fact chosen by our Patreons through last month's movie poll. If you want to help us choose movies in the future, become one of our patrons. And for as little as just $1 a month, aka $12 a year, you can help us choose movies, get some previews of what's coming up, and get tons of other fun behind-the-scenes content. So check it out. All right, so we might be a little bit in disagreement this week on whether or not we need antidotes or supplements for the movie and or movies that we have discussed today. But either way, we want to keep the fun going. So Chelsea, what would you suggest for us this week?
Listeners of the podcast may remember that I suggested Sabrina as an antidote to White Christmas when we recorded that episode of the summer. I'm going to keep the train rolling by recommending more Sabrinas. There is a Tamil, a Telugu, and a Hindi adaptation of Sabrina. So I'm recommending Yedlagi. I probably did not pronounce that correctly. That is the Hindi version of, or the Hindi adaptation of Sabrina that was filmed in 1994, starring Akshay Kumar, Saif Ali Khan, and Kajol, the ultimate goddess. I think, I haven't seen it, but it's definitely on my to-watch list. And it just sounds like a really fun remix of this classic story. My second supplement is New York Times has a new article. The New York Times travel section has a new article, How to Pretend You're in Paris Tonight. Unfortunately, it's behind a paywall, so that's also on my to-read list, but we all need to be able to pretend that we're in Paris. Bon voyage.
My suggestion this week is, it's a bit of a stretch, but it's more because of the date than because of the movie we're talking about right now. This should be coming out on Thanksgiving, so happy Thanksgiving, everybody. And I'm going to suggest a Thanksgiving movie, which is about a young woman who's coming into her own. And so that's the connection I'm going to draw to Sabrina. But it's the movie Pieces of April, which stars Katie Holmes. And it's an indie film from several years ago now that is about a young woman who lives in a shitty apartment in New York and is a bit estranged from her family, has had some addiction issues in the past, has a boyfriend who they haven't met and probably wouldn't like, and she invites them to come to her apartment for Thanksgiving and proceeds to prepare for their arrival, but her oven breaks, and so she ends up making friends with everyone in her building as she tries to prepare Thanksgiving dinner. It's a really sort of quirky, offbeat movie, and it's very dear and touching and is a lovely look at a more sort of modern version of someone trying to find their own voice as a young woman, and is a great Thanksgiving movie because it's really got a lovely message in the end. So that's Pieces of April. Janelle, do you have anything for us this week?
I do. Now, I want to preface this by saying y'all know that I am not the eat, pray, love kind. I am not charmed very often by these self-help memoirs. In fact, I often actually hate them. But the book that I want to recommend this week as an antidote to Sabrina is about a woman who is transformed at a crucial point in her life and subsequently falls in love with someone she didn't expect to fall in love with. The book is called Untamed by Glennon Doyle. And it's about, get this, after writing her first book about saving her marriage following bouts of alcoholism, drug addiction, and eating disorders, and infidelity, on her book tour for that book, she met and fell in love with soccer star Abby Wambach. So the book is about how, you know, after going through this huge transformation, she found love with a woman and a kind of self-satisfaction and self-actualization that she had never before had in her life. And while the parts of the book where she talks about parenting are not for me, because I'm not a parent, so I don't care, the parts where she talks about falling in love with the right person and the journey it takes to get there and how you not just have to love yourself, but you have to learn how to love was really powerful, especially because all of this happened after she was 40. And I think I needed to hear that this week, that you don't need to be 22 to change your life. So that's Untamed and Glennon Doyle.
You're here. Chelsea, thank you once again, as always, for joining us and defending this movie.
I have been waiting for this moment my entire life.
Thank you for listening to the Rom-Com Killjoys podcast. If you liked what you heard, be sure to follow us on Facebook and Instagram.
If you'd like to support us further, you can become a patron at patreon.com/romcomkilljoys.
Our theme song is Lady Slut Hitchhike Love by the band A Giant Dog, and the song you're listening to now is a cover of Baby Love by Colin Langaness.
Remember, Killjoys, don't let anyone kill your joy.
Not a rom-com. Not us.
Not anyone.
See you next time.